Hi, I'm Tony Rossi for The Christophers, and today's show will cover presidential politics and the role that journalists play in the process. I'll be joined by Face the Nation moderator John Dickerson to discuss his book, Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History. And we're also going to touch on the role religion has played in elections, as well as John's own Catholic faith and what it means to him. Stay with us. Christopher Close-Up starts right now. Hello and welcome to Christopher Close-Up. I'm Tony Rossi. Power, politics, religion, and the best and worst of human nature are usually on display during presidential election seasons, and nobody knows that better than John Dickerson. John is the political director of CBS News and moderator of Face the Nation, but he's also a presidential campaign historian who brings insight, energy, and humor to his popular Slate.com podcast, Whistle Stop. John has now collected a lot of those stories in a book, also titled Whistle Stop, and it gives readers insider coverage of election-turning moments past and present. We're going to talk about some of those today, and you'll also get to know the personal side of John, the husband and father, who attends Mass in the church in which he grew up. So to tell us more, I'm pleased to welcome to Christopher Close-Up, John Dickerson. Now, John, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, before reading Whistle Stop, I was looking at the 2016 presidential campaign, and I thought it was unique and unprecedented in the sense of the divisiveness, in the sense of insults being thrown at the candidates against each other, against the voters. But then I'm reading your book, and for instance, I read about Harry Truman comparing Republicans to Hitler and Mussolini and calling voters suckers. So I'm wondering, are there more parallels between past and present than we realize when it comes to presidential campaigns?
I think that's right. There are, and those are great examples. I mean, it's amazing to think that Harry Truman in 1948 would compare anybody to the Nazis. The memory of the Nazis was quite fresh. Usually when people do that today, it's because they've lost their sense of history. But Truman knew, and everybody knew, what the Nazis were like, and so that would have been an even greater insult than we have today. I think there are a lot of patterns that are repeated. The outsider who comes in and is an anti-establishment hero, which goes all the way back to Andrew Jackson in 1824, or Barry Goldwater in 1964, or George Wallace in 1968. So that tracks and repeats a lot of what we see in Donald Trump. On the other hand, Donald Trump is the first candidate we've got who's a kind of marketer, not just a businessman, but a person who's skilled in and whose chief profession is really marketing himself. Mm-hmm. We've never had a candidate like that before.
Right. But again, also from reading your book, I did also get a sense of how theater plays into these political campaigns. And, you know, I know we like to tell ourselves we want to know about the issues, but somehow we get sucked into the drama nonetheless. Was theater always such an important part of campaigning, or is it a more modern addition to the process?
Theater was in fact the initial. That's all campaigning was about, because it was seen as if you go back to the first time a candidate really campaigned for themselves in 1840, William Henry Harrison participated in Whig parades that were 8-hour drunken parades. Basically, they were not. Nobody was sitting down and talking about the where's and why fours of the tariff bills. it was always about basically selling people on the fun of it. And in fact, positions that candidates held and candidates speaking up for the positions they held, that was seen as untoward. No candidate would offer opinions about what they would do in office because it would suggest that they were making some kind of a commitment. And any president once in office had to make decisions based on the merits.
Sure, sure. I'm talking to John Dickerson. He's the moderator of CBS's Face the Nation, and we're talking about his book, Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History. Are there any candidates in history, you think, who were successful, particularly successful, at infusing actual substance into the theatrics?
Gosh, that's a great question. I think there have been bouts of it. A lot of times the substance comes in the primaries, where you have the debate between Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush in 1980 over tax rates and economic policy got quite specific. In 2008, the debate among Democratic candidates over health care got very, very specific, in part because candidates within the same party share the same general worldview, and to distinguish themselves, they have to kind of go further into policy to find distinguishing characteristics. Mm-hmm. In a general election, the candidates have bigger differences, and so it tends to be a little bit more blunt than what you have in a primary race.
Sure, sure. Well, this question's a little off the beaten path, but it's because all the media we do here at the Christophers revolves around this idea that it's better to light a candle than curse the darkness. And I was wondering, could that idea be applied to an election campaign? Could a candidate win by just appealing to the better angels of our nature, or does there almost need to be some kind of ratio between positive and negative campaigning to be successful?
Well, that's, first of all, a wonderful mission, and one that I wish were in politics more than it is. I mean, there have been candidates who have tried, and there have been inspirational candidates who have had a greater share of their message being about inspiration than attack. Barack Obama was one. Ronald Reagan was another, although Reagan, much of his pitch was about the failure of the Washington welfare state and big government, so it had a very critical element to it. Some races have been better than others. In 1988, it was a particularly dreary race. Efforts by Michael Dukakis to run a more optimistic campaign just didn't survive in terms of the nature of the combat. So more often than not, campaigns have been kind of had a very negative side to them. And in fact, in our current one, the notion of uplift, the notion of guiding everybody with a common dream seems to have really fallen as the candidates basically turn the race into a referendum on each other.
Yeah, yeah. I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close-Up. I'm talking to John Dickerson, moderator of CBS's Face the Nation. We're discussing his book, Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History. One of the chapters in the book is about John Kennedy, the Catholic candidate. And since this is a Catholic radio show, I want to talk about that. But first, I'm also curious, before we get to Kennedy, was there a big emphasis on God or religion in campaigns prior to 1960, or was that a watershed year?
Well, you know, there was an emphasis before. Going back all the way to 1800, when John Adams was running against Thomas Jefferson, Adams claimed that, Adams' supporters really claimed that Jefferson was going to take Bibles out of people's houses,
wow.
That he was a deist who didn't care about religion, and so he's very much a part of that race in terms of denigrating Jefferson, trying to make him seem like a godless humanist, and so it's always been in the races one way or another. In 1884, when Grover Cleveland had an out-of-wedlock child, there was certainly a religious component to the criticism of him,
mm-hmm.
And so it's come back and forth in the campaign. Certainly from time to time, but John Kennedy, just in terms of having and one other thing I would add, in 1884, one of the reasons that James G. Blaine lost is that a Reverend Burchard in New York was at a Blaine event and said that the Democrats bowed to the gods of rum, Romanism, and rebellion. The Irish
oh,
Catholics
wow.
in New York were furious about that shot at the Pope,
uh-huh.
and made Blaine pay for it. So religion has threaded throughout our politics, but certainly in 1960 was a very big deal in the Catholic candidate, and also the first Catholic to kind of beat the system. The worry that it was that he would be another Al Smith and that his Catholicism would hurt him too much.
Yeah. Well, was it Kennedy himself who made the Catholicism an issue, trying to attract more votes, or was it his opponents looking to drive a wedge between the public and someone who was this kind of upstart, likable candidate?
Well, at first, Kennedy didn't want his Catholicism to be a part of the conversation at all, in part because he was trying to use the primaries in a way that other candidates had been unsuccessful in doing, which was arguing basically, forget about his youth, forget about the fact that he was a Catholic. If he could win the primaries, then Democrats at the nominating convention should give him the nomination because he would have proved in the primaries that he had a connection with the people. It was deemed a Catholic victory, in which the pollsters even said Republican Catholics went into the Democratic contest and voted for their man simply because of his religious affiliation. That undermined his claim that people were voting for him because they wanted him to be the best president.
Right.
And he was furious about that. And then in West Virginia, the next contest, he decided, I can't deduct this. I can't avoid the issue. And he took it head on, ran television commercials in which he had voters asking him about his Catholicism, and in which he essentially said, look, I wouldn't have fought for my country and almost died in its service, and my brother, who did die in its service, We all signed up to support our country. We didn't think about our religion at that time, and that's the way he would govern as president. And in West Virginia, where there was only 4% of the population was Catholic, where it was a big issue, the fact that he won there was used as evidence and seen as evidence that he could overcome the Catholic question. And he essentially overcame it by embracing it rather than trying to run from it.
Right, right. I'm talking to John Dickerson about his book, Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History. So did Kennedy's candidacy reveal that there was still a threat of anti-Catholicism in the United States? Because by 1960, you've had successful TV shows from Fulton Sheen and Bing Crosby playing a priest on the big screen. So I thought America would have been over it by then. But there did seem to be an undercurrent from reading the chapter of anti-Catholicism still at that point.
There absolutely was an undercurrent of anti-Catholicism and then maybe a little lingering anti-Irish in there as well. So, in West Virginia in particular, there was a problem. There's one quote from Teddy White, who interviewed a woman in West Virginia who said, if America was supposed to have a Catholic president, they would have put it in the Constitution. Misunderstanding her civics there as well.
Yeah.
And then, of course, in the general election, he had to give the famous speech to Baptist ministers in Houston, in which he again addressed the question of his race and his religion, and whether he would be beholden to Rome and the Pope. So it wasn't totally done away with in the primaries. So it was certainly a question, but his candidacy and his victory sort of put that away in terms of, at least for Catholic candidates in U.S. history.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the more modern elements to politics is social media, not just in terms of a candidate's presence there, but the fact that voters can live in news silos of sorts where they only get news from the viewpoint they already agree with. And in a sense, I think that makes voters in the information age, ironically, less well-rounded when it comes to the experiences of others who believe differently. What's your take on social media's role in campaigning and in modern politics?
I think you're right. It does allow people to cocoon themselves. I think that another role that it plays, which is not good for the system, is that the hottest voices tend to participate in social media, the people who are on the edges of the spectrum on both the left and the right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a hard medium for tolerance. And what happens is, and studies have shown this, that people in the middle, people who don't have really doctrinaire positions on one side or the other of an issue, tend to watch the debate as it plays out among those most heated voices, and they opt out. They just decide, look, this is not a conversation I want to get in. Nobody's learning anything. It's just a bunch of unpleasant accusations back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that drives the more reasonable, leavening, tolerant voices from the debate. And that's definitely not good, because, of course, we all know that life is much more complex than can be put forward in a 140-character tweet.
Absolutely. I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close Up. I'm talking to CBS's Face the Nation moderator, John Dickerson. His book is called Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History. He also has a podcast on Slate.com with the same name. Let me ask about journalism in particular, too, because also in your chapter on Harry Truman's reelection in 1948, you say that campaign, quote, exemplifies the familiar modern tale in which pundits completely misread the electorate, close quote. So I'm curious, why do pundits misread the electorate when they supposedly have all the inside information? How does that happen?
Well, in 1948, it was a particular failure. What happened was essentially everybody thought they knew what they... there's kind of a groupthink that took over in terms of analysis of Harry Truman. Also, polling was a much less sophisticated art back then, and
mm-hmm.
Elmo Roper, who was one of the lead pollsters at the time, stopped polling in September, basically saying nobody who had been ahead at this point ever lost. So he just stopped asking questions. And so, but I think in general, the reason journalists get things wrong is news is what surprises us. The fix to that is probably to have a much more elastic and humble view about where things are going. You can give some assessment of where things are, but if you think about it as being just a snapshot that can change, then that probably will give everybody a better way to sort of think about the information they get and recognize that it could very well change tomorrow. And it's something other than a failure of the system or a failure of the analysis or just some kind of act of trickery.
Right. Well, let me stay with the journalism aspect, because the other day you posted on your Facebook page this old memo from the 1960s that your mom, Nancy Dickerson, who was a pioneering, groundbreaking newswoman, broadcast journalist, in case people aren't familiar with her, she posted this memo. You posted the memo, and the gist of it was saying that the Washington, D.C. press corps live in, quote, an insulated world, and they often forget that the average person doesn't think exactly like they do. How has that idea impacted your career? Is that something she conveyed to you, that idea to be more aware of what was going on outside the press corps establishment as you were pursuing your own journalism career?
That's definitely something that she conveyed to me in growing up and in her autobiography. The beginning sentence is about growing up in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin, not in the coast, so part of the heartland of America. And so that was always her view, and it was wonderful to find that memo, because you can sort of remember things in a vague way, but there it was, all in black and white, about the cocooning nature of the way the press works, and it's kind of always been that way.
Yeah. Well, let me stick with the personal side of John Dickerson, because I read a Parade magazine interview with you a while back, and you mentioned that you attend 5:30 Mass on Saturday evenings in the church where you grew up. How does that weekly hour of worship weave its way into your life as, say, a husband, father, and journalist? Does it ground you in a certain way?
Oh, it absolutely does. And it grounds me in for all the reasons that the Catholic faith does for all of us who worship. But for me, also going to the church, Holy Trinity, where I went to Mass as a little boy, where I had my first communion. And the priest who married us was from Holy Trinity, Father James English, who just passed away. It's full of so many memories of my life and my childhood and the grounding nature of faith that that I've all kind of reached to, it's a wonderful church, and also particularly in the pace of politics and the world of television, there are a lot of things that can kind of blow you off course and make you forget yourself, and that hour of worship and just worship in general, though I'm not as good as I should be, really helped me try to keep the eye on the ball instead of getting distracted.
Sure. Well, how did those seeds of faith get planted in your life? Did it come to you from your family, from friends, just from experiences in general?
I think, Mom in particular was a very devout Catholic. My grandmother, her mother, went to Mass every day. My mother went to Clark College for 2 years in Dubuque, Catholic girls' school. And so faith was a very important part of her life as a part of my growing up. I know it all. It certainly came in those. My father converted and became a Catholic. So even after my parents split, when I lived with my father, I would go to Mass. It just kind of, at that same church when I was in high school, it just kind of always has been with me. I ended up marrying a Presbyterian, and we've both continued to worship, and that's very much a part of our lives and our lives as we raise our children. So we are hoping to do the kind of job our parents did with us in terms of trying to keep our children involved in the faith as much because of the role it's played in our lives.
Sure. Well, has being a parent affected the way you approach your job as a journalist or even look at politics in general, since the decisions being made are going to affect your kids down the road?
It does help and put a different frame on the way you think of policies and politics, both as because this is the world that they will live in, the world in which the future presidents will be making decisions that will affect their lives, but also just in terms of, when I talk to my kids about what it's like to be fair to the politicians I cover, what it's like to be fair to people who disagree with you or people who have a different view of the world than you do, all of that, when you have to say it out loud and talk about the sort of first principles of politics and journalism, explaining it to kids, it helps you put yourself back in touch with what your goals should be as a professional in a way that is very grounding. You want to model those views for your kids and be the kind of person that you hope they think you are. That's quite grounding in an institution where you can sometimes get focus on other things which aren't so essential.
I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close Up. I'm talking to moderator of CBS's Face the Nation, John Dickerson, about his book, Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History. I've noticed just from talking to you, from watching you on Face the Nation, from hearing the podcast Whistle Stop on Slate.com, you have a great sense of humor, and you don't seem to have that hardened reporter's cynical edge that some people do. How have you managed to stay that more optimistic, hopeful person in the midst of a field that doesn't always bring out the best in human nature?
Well, it's a bit of a challenge. I think mostly it's because, I try to see the good in people. I think bringing joy to others and not focusing always on the most cynical and dire parts of things is an important way to just live one's life. Mm-hmm. I tend to think that being judgmental, because again, going back to my faith, judge not lest ye be judged, that you can be an analyst and assess things in as clear-eyed a fashion as you can without slipping over into judging people's motives, judging their heart, and getting into more corrosive part of snap judgments, which condemn people and entire classes of people based on their acts. I just think that if we think about people as being more human with all of their frailties and complexities and recognize that in ourselves, it's a better way to approach life than to be so ruthlessly judgmental in the way that we discard people.
Right. No, it's a perfect comparison. I'm wondering, did your mom, Nancy Dickerson, teach you about, say, staying grounded in that, seeing the other person as a human being instead of as just a label? I mean, what is her lasting legacy with you, both personally and professionally?
Well, I think that she did. She probably conveyed that sense of judgment more by indirection. In other words, introducing me to faith, and she was a good. She had a good heart and was a good person. She was not. She did not lack in judgment. However, she was quite judgmental about some people, and I think that we all have that side of us, and she that was something that was a part of her character. So I've learned lessons both directly and indirectly from her. But she was a good person, and felt also was constantly thinking, as that memo to herself shows, about what's the right way to do things, not just sort of what's the way to do them the way everybody else has been doing them, but what's the better approach, what are the standards by which we should behave and how we should do our job and act in life. And the other big lesson from her was that she was the hardest working person I know and had amazing grit, despite being turned down for jobs and being told that she couldn't do be on television because she was a woman. And she just kept at it. And that sense of drive and grit is something that I take a lot of example from.
Right. Well, I mean, that sense of drive and grit she modeled for you, in a way, it reminds me of the Christopher idea that I talked about before, it's better to light a candle than curse the darkness. When you hit times of darkness in your life, what do you do to metaphorically light that candle and move toward a brighter future?
Well, I think what I do is try and focus on and try and keep in my day a lot of small acts of candle lighting as best as I can do them, just with the people I meet, with the friends I have. There's a way in which you can plan your day or try to plan your day where if it's a part of your routine, just to try to bring some light. Then, when the dark moments hit, obviously your faith is very strong. My family and my wife and my children are a constant source of brightness in my life. And I think, and something I learned from a friend of mine, that his mother, another Catholic, but his mother used to say, in terms of just constantly thinking about the by the measurement of eternity, these small moments of darkness are, they're small relative to the longer timeline. And that's something that he is reminded me of and taught me in his life. He's also a person in the public eye, and taking the lesson from him has been helpful to me.
Right, right. No, that's a beautiful concept. And in our final minute, let's circle back to the beginning with Whistle Stop, the book. What are your hopes for people who read Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History?
I think my biggest hope is that people have fun with it, that people find the stories just entertaining and enlightening and instructive about the American story. And I think then by indirection or osmosis, they get a sense of control over the events that are coming at them. By looking at history, we get a sense that there are patterns, that things are not as dire as they may look in the moment. And that with those patterns, you can see maybe what's coming and therefore feel more control over quickly moving events. And also that you can feel maybe a little more at ease that as chaotic as things may look in the present, they had felt chaotic in the past and we've gotten through. And so, again, in the long picture of history, things turn out usually okay for the American political system. And that mostly that's because we've had good people striving for good ends, and that needs to continue. This isn't an argument for complacency, but it is an argument that the struggle is worth keeping, even though it seems maybe a little dark at times.
Right. I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close-Up. I've been talking with John Dickerson about his book, Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History. I'm reading through it right now, and it makes history both educational and entertaining and fun, like John said. And I think everybody should pick it up because it really does give you a sense of how past and present are connected. And we see lots of echoes of the past in the present campaign. And there's just a lot of entertaining characters and stories and personalities in this book. So please pick it up. It's called Whistle Stop, and tune in to John on Face the Nation Sunday mornings and his Whistle Stop podcast on Slate.com. John, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Tony, it was a great joy. Thank you for having me.
Now, before we end today's show, here's a message the Christophers would like to share with you.
In a world with millions of distractions, it's all too easy to lose sight of God in the midst of housework or homework or a hard day at the office. Yet God continues to speak to you, even in your busiest or most distracted moments. That's why the Christophers have prepared a news note called Listening When God Speaks. It shares stories about people who have learned to recognize God's voice in their lives and offers advice on how you can do the same. To request your free copy of Listening When God Speaks, send an email to radio@christophers.org or call our toll-free number at 1-888-298-4050. We look forward to hearing from you.
In closing, I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in today, and I encourage you to visit our website at christophers.org to learn more about the Christophers and to download free literature and podcasts. When you're there, you can also find links to our blog and our Facebook and Twitter pages. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can send an email to radio@christophers.org. Our engineers for today's show are John Pappas and Brian Bonifacio, and I'm Tony Rossi, your host. Thanks again for joining us, and remember that it's better to light one candle than to curse the darkness.